Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Service Culture Handbook, a step-by-step guide to getting your employees obsessed with customer service. By Jeff Toyster, narrated by Roger Wayne. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures and supplementary materials present in the print and e-book editions of the book. These materials are available on Jeff Toyster's website. Introduction. Tony DiUdo wanted to create an unforgettable experience. He's an airport operations center manager at the Tampa International Airport. Small children often lose a favorite stuffed animal while traveling through an airport, so DiUdo's goal was to reunite a child with a lost toy in a fun and unique way. His plan was to take photos of the toy in various places around the airport to make it look like the stuffed animal had gone on a big adventure. He would then return the toy to the child along with photographs of its journey. DiUdo asked a colleague who oversaw the airport's lost and found department to alert him the next time a child lost a stuffed animal. Once the plan was in place, he waited and waited. It took 2 months for it to happen. DiUdo was ready when he finally got the call. A 6-year-old boy had lost his stuffed tiger, Hobbs. The boy and his Tampa-based family had already boarded their outbound flight when Hobbs was found, so it was too late to return it to them that day. DiUdo jumped into action. Being a hobbyist photographer, I thought I could have some fun and creativity with the ways I took photos of Hobbs's adventure during my lunch break, said DiUdo. He enlisted help from various people around the airport to photograph Hobbs with airport firefighters, riding on a luggage cart, by the airport control tower, and elsewhere. DiUdo took his photos to Walgreens, where he used a coupon he had saved to make a hardbound photo book documenting Hobbs's adventure. He then brought Hobbs and the photo book to the airport's lost and found department, so the family could retrieve them when they returned from their trip. The family had been told that the boy's stuffed animal was waiting for them at the airport's lost and found. They headed there immediately after their flight landed, eager to reunite Hobbs with their son. It was a touching reunion, and the boy really enjoyed seeing the pictures of Hobbs on his great adventure. DiUdo's initiative had taken the traumatic experience of losing a favorite toy and turned it into something positive and fun. The boy's mother was moved to tears at the kindness displayed by DiUdo and the rest of the Tampa airport staff. The heartwarming story attracted national media attention. It was picked up by news outlets such as NPR, CNN, and USA Today. You just don't hear customer service stories like this very often. There are plenty of stories about service failures. Every week, there seems to be yet another company featured in a news story about shockingly poor service. Customer service leaders privately tell me they struggle simply to get their employees to consistently deliver basics such as courtesy, promptness, and helpfulness. Why are the stories about outstanding customer service so rare? That's not due to a lack of ideas. Bookstores are well-stocked with books explaining how to provide outstanding customer service. Some describe how companies can create successful service strategies, while others provide tips and tactics for customer-facing employees. There are many other places where you can find customer service ideas. There are conferences, motivational speakers, and seminars galore. Consultants like me write blog posts, record podcasts, and create videos. Nearly every customer service professional has attended a customer service training class at some point during their career. The stuffed animal photo adventure certainly isn't a new concept. DiUdo got the idea after reading a similar story about a child who lost a stuffed lion at a museum in London, England. It's also been done by a museum in Canada, and a Ritz-Carlton in Florida did the same thing with a stuffed giraffe in 2012. The original concept may have come from a story about a lawn gnome that was stolen from a garden in the mid-1980s and returned to its owner with a photo album depicting its various adventures. Or it may have originated from a popular children's book called Flat Stanley, which was published in 1964. I asked Ayudo why he went to so much trouble on his own time just to create a memorable experience for one child. Tampa International Airport has a long history of being very people-focused, as opposed to plane-focused, he told me. He explained that everyone in the airport, from the CEO on down, is committed to providing exceptional service. Our CEO, Joe Lupano, sets the tone for being efficient and hard-working, but he also fosters a sense of creativity and fun at the airport, which makes employees feel comfortable enough to take a chance like I did with this little boy's lost tiger. That's the real secret that explains why these types of stories are so rare. Tampa International Airport has done something that few organizations achieve. The airport has created an environment where employees are constantly thinking about outstanding service. They proactively look for ways to make a difference in their customers' lives, even if it means going far beyond their regular responsibilities. Employees prioritize passengers over planes, recognizing that airport operations are really just a means to help travelers get to wherever they're trying to go. Perhaps that's why the airport is consistently rated one of the best in the U.S. in Condé Nast's annual readers' poll. In short, employees there are obsessed with service. The Service Culture Handbook shows you how to create a customer-focused culture where employees in your organization are obsessed with service. It's a step-by-step guide to help customer service teams, business units, and even entire companies get excited about serving customers at the highest level. You'll get an inside look at companies like REI, JetBlue Airlines, and Publix that consistently rank near the top of their industries for customer service. You'll also find profiles of some lesser-known companies that represent the next wave of legendary customer service organizations. This book will show you what these elite organizations do that most organizations don't. The Service Culture Handbook is organized into three parts. The first part examines why creating a customer-focused culture is the key to outstanding customer service. It also offers some cautionary tales about companies whose culture initiatives failed. The second part provides detailed instructions for building a customer-focused culture. When you use these chapters to clearly define your organization's unique culture, you'll transform the way your employees view service. The ultimate goal is to get your employees obsessed with consistently delivering service that's so amazing, it becomes part of your company's brand image. Finally, the third part of the book helps you embed customer focus in your company's DNA so you can sustain the customer-focused culture you've created. Companies that get really good at service will tell you they have to work at it every day. It's easy to grow weary or lose focus when you've worked long and hard at achieving a goal. These chapters assist you in keeping your employees engaged and making outstanding service the way that your company, department, or team simply does business. Many chapters contain sample worksheets to help you implement these concepts. You can download blank copies of the worksheets from this book at serviceculturebook.com/tools. You'll also find additional tools and resources on the website, such as access to my Customer Service Tip of the Week email. You and your employees can sign up for these tips for free. I recommend that you listen to each chapter in order to get a clear picture of what it takes to create a customer-focused culture. You may be tempted to pick and choose lessons from this book. Please don't. This is a complete recipe for building a customer service culture. Just as you wouldn't try to bake a cake without flour or eggs, you shouldn't try to transform your organization's customer service while leaving out an essential ingredient. Also, it's a good idea to know exactly what you're getting into before you launch a major initiative. I won't lie to you. Getting your employees obsessed with customer service is not easy. It is, however, one of the elements that separates the elite organizations from the rest. These companies put in the hard work that most aren't willing to dedicate themselves to. Don't be afraid to use me as a resource as you explore these concepts. I'm easy to get in touch with. Call or text 619-955-7946. Email jeff@toystersolutions.com, Twitter @toyster. You'll also find additional analysis, tips, and trends to help you develop a customer-focused organization on my Inside Customer Service blog at toystersolutions.com/blog. For now, I encourage you to listen to Chapter 1, where you'll hear about another company whose employees are obsessed with customer service. In fact, these employees are so customer-focused that they did something that practically no one else would be willing to do. Part 1. Culture is the key to outstanding customer service. Chapter 1. How corporate culture guides your employees' actions. The internal network at Rackspace went down and took the phone system with it. Customers suddenly weren't able to call. Employees couldn't even access the company directory to contact each other. This was a potential disaster. Rackspace provides computer hosting services for more than 300,000 customers. These companies run their websites, email, and internal computer systems on its network. It's all mission-critical stuff. When there's a problem, Rackspace customers need help fast. A lone technical support agent sprang into action. He tweeted his personal phone number, letting customers know they could reach him directly if they needed help. Soon, other tech support reps followed suit and tweeted their numbers too. For the next 4 hours, they used Twitter and their cell phones to serve customers until Rackspace restored its phone service. The support team typically handles 1,000 calls during a 4-hour time frame, so their extraordinary service prevented a lot of unhappy customers. The stakes were high, but nobody from management told these employees to tweet their personal phone numbers. It wasn't part of a carefully scripted procedure. No one even asked permission. They just did it. How culture creates hero moments. Imagine the same scenario at nearly any other company. Employees would feel helpless. A few might lobby their supervisor to go home early. Most would just sit around and wait for the phone system to come back up. The corporate communications department might post a message on the company's website to let customers know the phones were down. Somebody might tweet an update on the status of the phone system. That would likely be the extent of the company's efforts to alert customers to the problem. Tweeting personal contact information would be unthinkable. Many customer service employees are fearful of giving out their last names, let alone their phone numbers. Employees at the average company would never take the kind of initiative that happened at Rackspace. Rackspace isn't the average company, though. Stories of employees delivering over-the-top service are common. One rep ordered a pizza for a customer during a marathon troubleshooting session after she heard him mention that he was getting hungry. An account manager showed her appreciation for a visiting client by preparing a home-cooked meal. The big question is why employees at Rackspace serve their customers in a way that's so different from the norm. That's too simplistic to say that Rackspace has made a company-wide commitment to provide outstanding service. Lots of companies make similar claims, but that doesn't mean they actually do it. Their exceptional service isn't just a product of great training either. Training works when you want to show someone how to use a specific skill or follow a particular procedure. Tweeting personal phone numbers, ordering pizza for a customer, and preparing a home-cooked meal for a client were all improvised moves. These actions were neither trained nor scripted. The real secret to Rackspace's extraordinary service is their customer-focused culture. Employees are absolutely obsessed with taking care of their customers. They have created a unique identity, calling themselves Rackers, symbolizing the pride employees have in their company. They've developed a special brand of customer service called Fanatical Support that promises customers they'll spring into action and do whatever it takes to help resolve any issue. It's this obsession that leads to customer service hero moments like tweeting a personal phone number so customers can reach you. A hero moment occurs anytime an employee, a team, or an entire company rises to the occasion to provide customers with outstanding service. Hero moments aren't limited to over-the-top actions. They include everyday service encounters as well. In his book, Be Your Customer's Hero, customer experience strategist Adam Toporek defines it this way. It means being there when the customer needs you and making your personal interaction with the customer as memorably positive as possible. Let's face it. The vast majority of customer service interactions are unremarkable. They're neither amazingly good nor frustratingly bad. Think about the last time you went to the bank, bought a cup of coffee, or ordered something online. There's a good chance that nothing particularly extraordinary happened. It was business as usual. A few experiences do stand out. We certainly remember the service failures, but we also remember the hero moments. Maybe you remember a kind bank teller who helped you avoid a fee. Perhaps there's a barista at your local coffee shop who makes you feel special every time he's there because he knows your name and your favorite drink. Or there may have been a time when you were shipped the wrong item, but the friendly customer service rep made the resolution so easy that you vowed to become a customer for life. Every customer interaction is an opportunity for a hero moment or a service failure. Some businesses, like hotels, might have multiple interactions per day with the same customers. According to the Cornell Center for Hospitality Research, an average 250-room hotel has 5,000 daily guest interactions with valets, door people, bell staff, reception, restaurants, housekeeping, engineering, and other functions. The largest businesses might serve millions of customers on a daily basis. For example, Domino's Pizza delivers more than 1 million pizzas per day, 7 days a week. Imagine all the customer service interactions required to make that happen. About 500,000 of those orders are taken by an employee. The rest are taken electronically via their website, smartphone app, etc. Employees must also deliver those 1 million pizzas. That means Domino's averages about 1.5 million hero or failure opportunities every day. Individual employees at some companies might personally serve dozens of customers per day. For example, a typical airline flight might have 150 passengers served by 4 flight attendants. A retail cashier might serve 20 customers or more per hour. A contact center agent might serve 10 or more customers per hour. It's impossible for a boss, a policy, or a system to control all these interactions. Employees must exercise independent discretion at times. This is a scary reality for customer service leaders who worry their employees will do something wrong. I've spoken to thousands of customer service employees over the years. Most want to do a good job and make their customers happy. The vast majority of these employees know how to deliver a hero moment, but they aren't actively looking for them. Sometimes the moment arises, but the employee doesn't feel empowered to spring into action. These are situations where the right corporate culture can encourage employees to make good decisions. Culture creates hero moments on an individual level, where an employee strives to deliver the best customer service possible. That employee feels empowered to do what it takes to make customers happy and takes pride in the company he or she works for. You see it in the way the employee greets customers, solves problems, and goes the extra mile when the situation demands it. Culture also creates hero moments on a team level, where a department works together to serve its customers at a consistently high level. Team members share a passion for service that's absolutely contagious. You see it in their pervasive can-do attitudes and in the way they support each other in a collective effort to make their customers happy. These employees take pride in their team, yet always push each other to do even better. Culture can create hero moments on an organizational level as well, where an entire company is dedicated to providing outstanding service. Strategy, goals, policy, and other corporate decisions are made with the customer in mind. You see the impact of this customer focus in the legions of loyal customers who go out of their way to do business with these select companies. It's no wonder that culture is such a hot topic in customer service. So, what exactly is it? The definition of corporate culture. Corporate culture can be a nebulous subject. There's a lot that goes into it, like mission, vision, and value statements. But while those are some of its elements, a company's culture is broader than that. I turned to Catherine Mattis to get a clear definition. She's a consultant and trainer who specializes in helping organizations create a positive workplace culture. She's also the author of Back Off, Your Kick-Ass Guide to Ending Bullying at Work. And her research on the topic has made her an in-demand speaker at human resources conferences. Mattis has even served as an expert witness in court cases where corporate culture was a factor. We met for coffee on a warm, sunny day. The coffee shop had a patio with just enough shade to make it comfortable. I thought it might be a short conversation, but we ended up talking for several hours. We discovered that the challenge in defining culture is that there are so many valid perspectives. When Mattis helps companies end workplace bullying, she does so by focusing on their culture. I, too, focus on culture when I work with companies to help improve customer service. And when another colleague helps companies with their branding, she begins her efforts by focusing on their corporate culture as well. It seems that so many things companies do can be boiled down to their culture. Mattis and I agreed that while corporate culture can refer to an entire organization, it can also refer to a business unit, location, or individual team. It's not unusual for groups in different parts of a company to share some common characteristics, yet also have their own unique identity. You can't easily change the entire corporate culture if you're a store manager for a retail chain, but you can influence the culture within your particular store. Mattis shared this definition, which puts it all together. Corporate culture is the way an organization's members think, act, and understand the world around them. Let's use Rackspace as an example. Rackers certainly think, act, and understand the world around them differently than employees at most companies. When faced with an unexpected challenge such as the phones going down, Rackers think, "My customers need me. I have to find a way to help them." They act to do something about it. Rackers do this because they understand how critical their services are to their clients' businesses. Contrast this to the customer service most of us receive every day. Many employees think about their job solely in terms of their assigned responsibilities. They act in accordance with company policies and procedures, but rarely take initiative. They understand their role, but may not understand the company's goals. Or employees might understand the company's goals, but not care about helping to achieve them. All organizations have a culture. It doesn't have to be something intentionally created. In most organizations, culture organically develops over time through corporate strategy, the decisions of its leaders, the way employees interact with each other, and many other factors. It's natural for a group of people to develop a certain amount of collective thinking. When you hear people say, "That's how we do things around here," they're referring to their company's culture. A few elite companies like Rackspace intentionally strive to cultivate a positive, customer-focused culture. That intentionality is what's missing in many organizations. According to Mattis, most companies have policies that tell employees what they should not do. Companies with positive cultures help employees understand what they should do. Mattis explains that without clear guidance, people don't know how else to act. But you can't tell employees specifically what to do in every situation. There are too many variables. Instead, an intentionally guided culture acts as a compass that consistently points employees in the right direction. That culture is reinforced when employees encounter a hero moment and make the right decision. Inside Rackspace's customer-focused culture. Rob Legess is the Vice President of Social Strategy at Rackspace. Most corporate executives in publicly traded companies are hard to contact. Not Legess. I got his phone number when he sent it to me via Twitter. I asked Legess why he shares this information so freely. His explanation was simple. "I'm in the people business. I want people to find me." He's not kidding. Legess published his cell phone and home phone numbers on his blog in 2009. It was 2013 when the Rackspace technical support rep tweeted his own cell number in order to be accessible to customers in need. Sharing a personal phone number via social media wasn't a scripted move, but it was embedded in the company's organizational thinking and exemplified by its leaders. Accessibility is just one illustration of how Rackspace creates a customer-focused culture. Another is how it hires employees. According to Legess, the company hires many people who don't have technical backgrounds. They come from hospitality, medical, and similar professions that attract people with natural empathy. Legess shares an example of the type of people they like to hire at Rackspace. He was attending an off-site meeting at a hotel. The meeting ended for the day, and the attendees headed off to the hotel's bar. There were only three bartenders who were working like crazy to keep up. Legess ordered a frozen margarita but received a margarita on the rocks. He was deep in conversation with a colleague and saw the long line at the bar, so he decided not to bother with getting his order corrected. A few minutes later, the bartender approached Legess with a frozen margarita. He apologized for the error and told Legess that both drinks were on the house. Legess was impressed. Mistakes can and will happen, especially during busy times, but it takes a special kind of person to recognize their mistake and go out of their way to fix it when the customer hadn't complained. He waited for the bar to calm down a bit and then approached the bartender. Legess handed him his business card and said, "You need to be a racker." The bartender was eventually hired by Rackspace. Although he had no experience working with computer networks, he turned out to be a perfect fit. He now has a successful career in technical sales. "I can teach anybody the computer operating system Linux," said Legess. "I can't teach them to actually care." Rackspace specifically looks for people like this who fit the company's customer-focused culture. Here's a passage from its fanatical support promise. "We cannot promise that hardware won't break, that software won't fail, or that we will always be perfect. What we can promise is that if something goes wrong, we will rise to the occasion, take action, and help resolve the issue." This isn't just something that's tucked into an employee handbook and then forgotten. This promise is a way of doing business at Rackspace. It's how Rackers think, from executive leadership all the way to the employees on the front lines of customer service. Fanatical support is the first of the company's six core values. 1. Fanatical support in all we do. 2. Results first, substance over flash. 3. Treat Rackers like friends and family. 4. Passion for our work. 5. Full disclosure and transparency. 6. Committed to greatness. What truly makes these values special is that they're ingrained in hiring, training, and all aspects of guiding the employee's work. The company even has a culture page on its website to explain it all. Our core values came from us, the employees. They are our collective thoughts and beliefs encompassed by six values. Our leadership had no input or vote in them. We wouldn't even let them spell check our values. Luckily for us, our bosses are smart enough to know that telling employees what to think and believe is a complete waste of time and just a bad idea all the way around. These values truly represent how Rackspace does business. You see this in an employee tweeting his cell phone number to be accessible to customers in need. You see it in a bartender who gets hired after going out of his way to fix a drink order. In fact, you see examples of fanatical support reinforced every single day at Rackspace. "You have to constantly work at it," said Legess. "You have to constantly talk about it." The dark side of corporate culture. What leaders constantly work at and talk about has a profound impact on a company's culture. It shapes how employees think about, act upon, and understand service. Focus on the wrong things, and a company can unintentionally develop an anti-customer culture. Comcast provides a clear warning. It's generally considered to have some of the worst customer service in the country. It was rated the worst internet service provider in the United States by the 2015 American Customer Satisfaction Index, and third and fourth worst, respectively, in subscription television and phone service. Comcast also ranked dead last in the 2015 Temkin customer service ratings. Comcast has been known to attract national media attention with its epic service failures. One particular example happened in July 2014. A Comcast subscriber named Ryan Block called to cancel his service. The customer service agent inexplicably stonewalled his request. Block was 10 minutes into the call when he decided to record it. The recording lasts for approximately 8 minutes. On it, you can hear the Comcast employee repeatedly badgering Block about his decision to cancel. Block politely asked the agent to cancel his service multiple times, but the employee continuously tried to talk him into retaining his account. Block posted the recording online, and it quickly went viral. Major news outlets reported on it. Tom Karinchak, Comcast's senior vice president of customer experience, issued a statement apologizing for the incident. "We are very embarrassed by the way our employee spoke with Mr. Block and are contacting him to personally apologize. The way in which our representative communicated with him is unacceptable and not consistent with how we train our customer service representatives." It's convenient for companies like Comcast to blame a rogue employee for an embarrassing service failure like this. However, a closer look reveals that the employee's actions were completely reflective of Comcast's corporate culture. Canceling an account with Comcast in July 2014 was a difficult task. The instructions weren't easy to find on its website. Even searching "cancel account" failed to point customers to the desired result. Customers who did find the cancellation instructions were instructed to call customer support. They could do almost anything online, including adding services, but Comcast wanted them to call to cancel. Customers who called to cancel their accounts were transferred to someone called a retention specialist. These employees were given training on step-by-step procedures they were expected to use to discourage customers from canceling. They received a bonus based on how many customers they could talk out of canceling their service. The employees received no bonus if too many customers insisted on canceling anyway. The retention specialist on Ryan Block's recorded call summarized the role perfectly. He said, "My job is to have a conversation with you about keeping your service." Comcast designed its entire cancellation process around trying to convince customers not to cancel. This philosophy was embedded in its process, and it was integrated into employee compensation. Retention was what these employees worked at and talked about. It's not hard to understand why Comcast is infamous for its poor service. Let's go back to Catherine Mattis's definition of corporate culture. The way a company thinks, acts, and understands the world around them. Comcast thinks about its customers in terms of revenue. It acts to do whatever it can to retain or increase that revenue in the short term. It understands that a lost account equals lost revenue. None of this focuses on serving customers. In an interesting twist to the story, Comcast announced in May 2015 that it was implementing a multi-year plan to create a new corporate culture focusing on exceeding customers' expectations. It seems that even Comcast, at some level, understands the importance of having a customer-focused culture. Comcast is hardly the only company whose actions create a culture of poor customer service. In my first book, Service Failure, I uncovered many examples of how a company's culture can lead to poor service. In one story, a hotel associate deliberately provided her guests with poor customer service because she was afraid of being ostracized by her coworkers if she went out of her way to be helpful. The hotel's poor culture made it uncomfortable for her to provide great service. Another story involved a bank employee who signed off on 400 home foreclosures per day without actually verifying that the homes met the criteria for foreclosure. He never stopped to consider the customers who owned those homes because the bank had a culture that encouraged employees to follow its procedures without question. A customer service representative at yet another company told me he routinely lied to customers because he was instructed to do so by management. He'd recently gotten this job after being out of work for a long time, and he was worried that he'd be out of work again if he didn't comply with management's directives. The company's leaders created a culture of fear, intimidation, and dishonesty. I discovered something else while researching these stories. We would like to believe that we wouldn't act the way those people did if we were placed in a similar situation. And the truth is, most of us would. We naturally take behavioral cues from the people around us. Some are conscious, like the customer service employee who lied to customers so he could keep his job. Others are unconscious, like the bank employee who mindlessly signed off on home foreclosures. They're both examples of corporate culture at work. Getting culture to guide employees' actions. People see how employees are obsessed with customer service in a company like Rackspace and think, of course, that's how it should be. That's what makes creating a customer-focused culture so maddeningly difficult. It seems like it should be easy, but it isn't. The challenge is that culture isn't attributable to just one thing. There's no single initiative that will magically get your employees to consistently make customer service a priority. Culture is the sum of all the things we do in an organization. Here are just a few examples of questions whose answers influence how culture shapes employee behavior. Are employees given clear guidance on the company's culture, or are they expected to just figure it out? Are employees invited to help shape the culture, or are they disengaged? Are strategic decisions driven by culture, or are they made without regard for customers? Are goals and metrics aligned with the culture, or do they encourage shortcuts? Are business processes customer-focused, or do they put employees in awkward situations? Are employees empowered to deliver outstanding service, or are they constrained? Do leaders reinforce the desired culture, or do they contradict it? Addressing these questions isn't easy. It takes time, energy, and resources. Building a customer-focused culture is a never-ending journey that tests the entire organization's commitment and dedication. So, before showing you how to build a customer-focused culture in your company, I've written the next chapter to explain why so many customer service culture initiatives fail. Chapter 2: Why Culture Initiatives Often Fail. I want us to be like the Apple Store. That's how a chief information officer, CIO, described the goal of his customer service project. He worked for a company that provided software and information services to corporate clients around the globe. He managed several internal departments, including a help desk team supporting the computing needs for several thousand employees spread across six continents. The company had an internal customer service survey, and his help desk wasn't scoring well. There had even been complaints about service quality from other executives. The CIO decided he needed to change the culture, and he wanted to get his employees obsessed about providing the type of outstanding customer service the Apple Store was known for. He called me to ask for help. We talked about his situation, and I pressed him for more details about his vision. What is it about the Apple Store that you want your team to emulate? There was a brief silence, as the CIO thought. Finally, he said, I like the Apple Store because they're good at customer service. That was the best description he could muster. The problem was that the Apple Store and his company's internal help desk operations were so different that the comparison made little sense. There was no similarity other than their focus on computers. The Apple Store is a gleaming showcase for Apple's latest technology. Employees are there to educate customers, help them find solutions, and sell products. Customers are drawn in by Apple's latest technology, whether it's an iPad, iPhone, MacBook, or another of Apple's latest gadgets. People also come to the Apple Store to get help with Apple products they'd purchased. The CIO's help desk is an internal department, not a retail store. It supports operations around the globe by phone, email, and internet. It also manages the logistics of configuring various computers, parts, and accessories, and shipping them to various offices. Ironically, the department's biggest challenge was employees based in its corporate office, who acted as if the help desk really was an Apple store. They often bypassed the company's work order system and walked directly into the IT department to get help. They used their physical proximity to jump to the head of the line and prioritize their needs over projects at remote offices. For example, a corporate vice president might come in looking for help with her laptop while a help desk employee was in the midst of getting a network configured for a new office in Europe. It wasn't a comfortable position for the employee. If he dropped everything and helped the vice president, he could put the network project behind schedule. If he asked the vice president to follow the appropriate procedure, that could result in the vice president complaining to the CIO or another executive. Another challenge was how help desk employees viewed their role. They didn't think of themselves as perky, customer-focused retail associates like those at the Apple store. They generally joined the company because they loved computers and wanted to be near cutting-edge technology. They viewed their job as fixing computers and setting up networks, rather than helping customers. The CIO's customer service project had many warning signs that suggested it wouldn't succeed. He was impatient and hoped to find a shortcut. He knew he needed to change the help desk's culture, but he naively thought that could be accomplished through a couple of training classes. He even signaled that the project didn't have his full support by delegating it to one of his managers so that he could focus on initiatives he felt were more important. The biggest challenge of all was that the CIO couldn't describe a successful project outcome. He had a picture in his mind, but it wasn't fully formed. The best he could do was point to the Apple store. This didn't sound like a situation where I could be helpful. I finally asked him, "Have you ever heard of Ron Johnson?" He hadn't. Ron Johnson and the Tale of Two Companies. Ron Johnson is widely credited for developing the Apple Store and making it successful. Apple hired him in 2000 to be its senior vice president of retail, and he worked closely with CEO Steve Jobs to develop the company's retail concept. The Apple Store's success is undeniable. In 2011, Johnson's last year there, its $5,626 in sales per square foot was the best mark for any retailer in the U.S. Apple was also named a J.D. Power Customer Service Champion for 2012, recognizing the company's outstanding service from the previous year. The Apple Store took a fresh approach to retailing in many ways. Its stores were full of products that customers were encouraged to try out. It also had more associates than typical stores, so customers could get hands-on assistance. There were no cashier lines either. Associates rang up purchases using a mobile credit card reader and an app on their phones. The centerpiece of each store was the Genius Bar, which was something Johnson invented to help customers get the most out of their Apple products. Johnson described the Genius Bar in a 2011 interview with Harvard Business Review. "Imagine a friendly place that dispenses advice and is staffed by the smartest Mac person in town. He would be like a genius to the customer because he knows so much." The Genius Bar concept wasn't a hit at first, but Johnson stuck with it. "I had a belief, a conviction that face-to-face support was going to be much better for customers than phone and web support, which are often really frustrating and ineffective," he explained. "So we stuck with it, and gradually customers started coming." In November 2011, Johnson was hired away to be the CEO of JCPenney. The company was enamored with Johnson's results at the Apple Store, as well as his previous success at Target, where he helped build a strong brand reputation. JCPenney's board of directors thought Johnson would be able to work his magic once again and transform a venerable retail brand that had stagnated in recent years. Johnson felt JCPenney's culture was stuck in the past. The company was trying to hang on to tradition instead of evolving to meet its customers' changing needs. Employees had a transaction mindset where constant sales, coupon programs, and other discounts were used to drive revenue. Perhaps worst of all, Johnson felt the company's leaders were too slow to take action. Johnson quickly developed an ambitious plan to completely change JCPenney's culture. There were massive layoffs at the corporate office. Johnson brought in a new executive team, many of whom were former Apple colleagues. One of those executives was Michael Kramer, who became JCPenney's chief operating officer. Kramer told the Wall Street Journal, "I hated the JCPenney culture. It was pathetic." Johnson instituted an autocratic decision-making approach that did away with market research and in-store testing. He announced sweeping changes based solely on his experience and gut instincts. "We didn't test at Apple," said Johnson to one colleague who questioned him. "Every initiative we pursue will be guided by our core value to treat customers as we would like to be treated. Fair and square," said Johnson. He scrapped the company's traditional discounting programs in favor of an everyday low-price approach called fair and square pricing. Millions were invested in new store layouts and merchandising agreements with popular brands that he believed would better resonate with JCPenney customers. Johnson also announced plans to create a section in the middle of each store called the Town Square. The Town Square would replace the cosmetic counters and accessories found in the center of a typical department store. Instead, it would feature various services for customers along with monthly attractions like free haircuts during back-to-school season. Johnson said the Town Square concept was similar to the Apple Store's Genius Bar. "Just like in the Apple Store, you have to walk through the products to get to the Town Square." There was one huge group of employees who were missing from Johnson's bid to overhaul the company culture: store associates. They held tremendous influence over the success of the company's widespread changes because they interacted with customers on a daily basis. An enthusiastic response might help convince lifelong customers that the changes were positive. Well, a lackluster reception could convince customers to take their business somewhere else. The associates largely disliked the changes. Many associates felt frustrated that they'd had no input into the company's new direction, and there were widespread accounts of plummeting morale. One store associate told Business Insider, "I hate it. I hate the disorder, and I hate having my customers give me that look, that you don't have any idea what you're doing, and I hate this place, and I'm never coming back look." There was also no change in how associates treated their customers. Customers who walked into a JCPenney store just before Johnson became CEO in 2011 were likely to have been ignored. The transactional culture in JCPenney stores at the time was largely one of indifference to helping customers on the sales floor. Cashiers believed their job was simply ringing up transactions. Stock associates believed their job was putting stock on the sales floor and arranging displays. After Johnson took over as CEO, company leaders did nothing to change this behavior, and employees still routinely ignored their customers. Johnson's efforts to transform JCPenney ultimately failed. The company's stock sank 40% in his first full year. Sales plummeted. JCPenney's ratings on the American Customer Satisfaction Index fell from 82 when Johnson took over in late 2011 to 77 in 2013. Johnson was fired in April 2013. Why borrowing another company's culture doesn't work? The software company CIO and Ron Johnson both failed at their culture initiatives in part because they tried to copy the Apple Store. The problem was that neither business was comparable to the one they tried to emulate. Each had products, operations, and employees that were different. Each had its own unique history. Even their customers were different. Johnson built a retail operation from the ground up at Apple. At JCPenney, he was trying to change a company that had been in business for over 100 years. Its employees already had a collective way of thinking, acting, and understanding the world around them. Johnson completely ignored this when he tried to sweep away the JCPenney culture and unilaterally impose his own. Trying to copy another company's culture is an exercise in futility. Every organization is unique. There are too many things that vary from company to company, such as business models, target customers, product line, organizational history, and even the skills and personalities of the individual employees who work there. That doesn't stop companies from trying to borrow other companies' culture. Bookstores are stocked with business books that profile service cultures at famous companies, including the Nordstrom Way, the Disney Way, the Virgin Way, the Cleveland Clinic Way, the Southwest Airlines Way. Executives from successful, high-profile companies are fixtures on the corporate speaking circuit. Some companies, such as Disney, Zappos, and the Ritz-Carlton, have even created business seminars designed to show other companies the inner workings of their unique cultures. These training programs all offer valuable insights and takeaways. Unfortunately, participants mistake the training for a paint-by-numbers blueprint. People buy the books and attend the trainings, hoping to capture the magic that made those famous companies successful. It's easy to forget that the principles and business practices described and discussed weren't developed overnight. Instead, they're a byproduct of the unique cultures these companies developed over time. Getting to where they are today took an intense commitment over multiple years. A book or seminar will not change your culture. It can inspire you. It can give you ideas. But you still have to put in the work to bring your own organization's unique, customer-focused culture to life. Employees often refer to copycat initiatives as a flavor-of-the-month program. Their company dedicates training and resources to imitate another company. But it never really sticks. The other company is just too different. The other culture doesn't match how this company's employees actually think, act, or understand the world around them. The company's leaders inevitably lose interest and move on to chase after another fad. In a typical example, a company sent its executives and mid-level managers to a seminar organized by the Disney Institute. The participants were impressed with what they learned, but they compared all the lessons to their own organization's culture. "That sounds cool, but it would never work for us," they thought. By the end of the seminar, the participants had only picked up a few tactics they thought would work. They returned to their office and set out to implement the few ideas they'd selected. What they didn't understand was that Disney developed its culture by doing all of it. These executives were essentially trying to bake a cake with only half the ingredients listed in the recipe. Failure was inevitable. How employees get lost without clear direction. It's hard for any corporate initiative to succeed if you don't first define a successful outcome. Yet, executives like the software company CIO frequently struggle to describe what they want their organization's unique culture to be like. This makes it nearly impossible to get employees aligned around a common way of thinking about, acting upon, and understanding customer service. In 2013, I did a survey to see how many companies had created a clear definition of outstanding customer service. As you'll learn in Chapter 3, this definition forms the basis of a customer-focused culture because it allows companies to engage their employees in delivering a consistent brand of customer service. Only 62% of respondents said their organization had created this definition. There are several reasons why companies don't define outstanding service for their employees. One reason is that it seems self-evident. People know good and bad service when they see it. The problem with this thinking is that people tend to have very different definitions of what constitutes great service. On a company level, outstanding service at the Apple Store is vastly different from outstanding service at JCPenney. Within a company, different departments have different goals and objectives. Even individual employees have their own ideas and priorities. Failure to align employees' collective thinking typically results in inconsistent customer service. Some organizations resist creating a customer service vision because they think of it as a lot of marketing fluff. For example, one company created a vision statement that was so long it literally covered the entire wall of their lobby. It was full of impressive-sounding adjectives, but it was also impossible to decipher. Employees snicker at attempts like this that feel inauthentic. Yet, employees need clear direction so they know what's expected of them. Creating a clear definition of outstanding customer service provides this direction, which is critical to creating a customer-focused culture. Chapter 3 gives you step-by-step instructions for developing your customer service vision. Everything else you do should be based on that vision. That makes Chapter 3 the most important chapter in this book. What happens when culture becomes a side project? Executives are impatient for results. They look for shortcuts and silver bullet solutions. Furthermore, culture initiatives can easily get relegated to side project status. Many executives feel these initiatives seem mushy and less easily defined than other activities whose results are simpler to measure. Here are just a few of the excuses I've heard for delaying a culture initiative. We're knee-deep in implementing a new computer system right now. We'd like to work on culture, but we don't have the budget. We're focused on employee engagement this year. These statements reflect a complete disconnect from what culture really is. Culture should be guiding these initiatives, not taking a back seat. How you approach a system upgrade should be influenced by your culture. It doesn't take a hefty budget to reorient your culture around serving customers. Employee engagement is, by definition, a culture initiative. One chief financial officer told me his company wasn't ready to focus on culture because they were working on improving customer experience. He told me his executive team didn't see a clear connection between internal culture and customer experience, what a customer thinks and feels about your business. Of course, this link is critical since it's the employees who design and execute the factors that create customer experience. Some customer service culture initiatives fail because they don't have the appropriate level of executive commitment. A 2015 Harvard Business Review report revealed that 51% of customer centricity initiatives are led by someone who isn't a senior executive. The same report found that 64% of these projects lack a dedicated team and budget. One explanation for this is that many companies feel they're already customer-focused. A 2014 study by Excess in the Know and Digital Roots showed that 88% of companies felt they were generally meeting the needs and expectations of their customers. Only 22% of customers felt the same way. Another explanation is that companies underestimate the level of time and resources required to build a customer-focused culture. The CEO of one organization delegated a culture initiative to a project team made up of several mid-level managers. It's okay to delegate work, but the CEO completely removed himself from the loop. He assumed the team would keep working on the project without his involvement. Those project team members had other responsibilities as part of their regular jobs. The CEO focused his communication with these managers on their normal roles and largely ignored the culture project. The initiative quickly took a back seat to day-to-day work and ultimately stalled out completely. Yet, the CEO didn't realize that it was his management that made culture seem unimportant. Some companies think they can change their culture just by sending frontline employees to training. This rarely works. Training can help employees develop knowledge, skills, or abilities. But while important, these are only a few of the many factors that influence an employee's actual performance. An employee's attitude, influence from their coworkers, and direction from their leaders also play pivotal roles. Likewise, policies, procedures, tools, and resources all impact an employee's ability to serve customers. I once facilitated a training class for a small organization. It was supposed to be an all-hands meeting, but when I arrived, I learned the organization's leaders had abruptly decided not to attend. Apparently, they felt they had more important things to do. Two employees approached me after the class. Both were near tears. They told me that they had appreciated the training and learned a lot, but they were concerned that none of it would make a difference. "The people that really needed to be here were our bosses," one of them said. "We really want to serve our customers, but the leaders around here aren't committed to it." This organization's leaders sent a clear message to their employees that day by skipping out on training that was mandatory for everyone else. They demonstrated that they weren't fully committed. They naively hoped the training would somehow fix their employees when it was really their leadership that needed fixing. Culture isn't a side project. It's a way of doing business that should be integrated into everything you do, and it needs unmistakable executive sponsorship if it's going to work. Building a strong culture takes time and full commitment. Chapters 5 through 10 are dedicated to providing step-by-step instructions for aligning the most critical aspects of your business with your culture. Why culture initiatives need a full commitment. A client invited me to attend her company's quarterly employee meeting. Employees gathered to hear updates from the CEO and other top executives about financial performance, strategy, key initiatives, and other business issues. The CEO kicked off the meeting by discussing the importance of the company's values. This wasn't unusual. The CEO talked about the company's values all the time. They represented the company's way of doing business, and the CEO wanted to emphasize their importance. The values described how they wanted to treat their customers, each other, and even their vendors. Culture wasn't just the CEO's pet project. Every executive at the company regarded culture as a top priority. They used their culture to guide all decisions, whether it was spending money, developing strategy, or training employees. The company's strategy gradually changed over the years as it grew and became even more successful. But the CEO and his top executives never wavered in their full and open commitment to supporting the company's culture. In their minds, it was the culture, above everything else, that made the company successful. Employees were constantly reminded of the corporate culture. It was embedded in the recruiting process, new hire training, employee development programs, and employees' discussions with their managers. Alignment with corporate culture was assessed during the performance evaluation process. Culture was baked into policies, procedures, and job descriptions. Culture was deliberately integrated into every aspect of the job. The company's service obsession paid off. Its customers were consistently delighted, which led to greater loyalty and a lot of word-of-mouth advertising. At the same time, its employees were highly engaged in delivering the company's unique brand of customer service. Even its vendors embraced the company's service culture and worked hard to provide the company with superior value and service. All these factors combined to help the company achieve a steady growth rate and financial returns well above average. Their culture emphasized the expectation that they constantly reinforce the culture. They thought culture was important, acted to make it important, and understood it was what helped make them successful. Other organizations may see some short-term improvement, but find it difficult to sustain a customer-focused culture over the long run. The wireless communications company Sprint provides an excellent example. The company had never really been known for outstanding customer service, but it sunk to a new low in 2007. That year, it earned a 61 on the American Customer Satisfaction Index, ACSI, which put it well behind its major competitors, AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile. The company lost over 1 million customers that year, including 1,000 customers whose contracts were infamously terminated for making what the company deemed to be an excessive number of customer service calls. Dan Hess was hired as Sprint's CEO in December 2007 to turn the company around. He immediately set about refocusing the company on customer service. This included establishing a set of core values to guide employee behavior, simplifying pricing plans to make them easier for customers to understand, and making improved customer service a part of every employee's compensation plan. The initial results were promising, with Sprint's ACSI rating climbing from a low point of 56 in 2008, just a few months into Hess's tenure, to an industry-leading 72 in 2011. Remaining at the top proved difficult as other distractions took the focus away from service. In late 2010, Sprint announced a multi-year, $5 billion plan to consolidate its existing network of three different wireless technologies into a single platform. In 2012, SoftBank reached an agreement to acquire Sprint by purchasing 70% of its stock. In 2013, Sprint and rival T-Mobile began negotiating a merger that never materialized. By 2014, Sprint's ACSI rating declined down to 68, and its number of retail wireless subscribers decreased 5.6% from 2012 to 2014. Hess left the company by the end of 2014. A 2013 Towers Watson survey found that only 25% of corporate change initiatives succeed. The few companies that do succeed at change initiatives do so through culture. As the Towers Watson report points out, the best actively build a culture to support and drive behavior aligned with their business strategy. Building the right culture is simply too much work for most companies. The few that break through work at it every day. They resist the urge to take shortcuts, and they stick with the initiative for the long term. These elite few companies understand that culture isn't easy, and they embrace that challenge. Are you ready for that challenge? Let's go to Chapter 3, where we'll start the process.